So there is a headline this afternoon in the Irish Independent that says there was a mad panic. The queue to rebook was the length of Terminal 2. Family lose €6,000 dream holiday after flight from Dublin Airport is cancelled. So I'm going to go through this story. Paul Hyland and Laura Linnett have it here. This family were going on a flight to Portugal. It was cancelled last minute. They are Wayne and Aoife Comerford. They travelled from Greystones in County Wicklow to Dublin Airport yesterday for a 7 p.m. flight to Faro in Portugal. They had their three children with them, ages 11, 9 and 5. They arrived at Terminal 2 at 3 p.m, so 4 hours before their flight to Portugal, obviously within the EU. Usually it's around, what do they say, 2 hours kind of to turn up. They joined the Aer Lingus, because they're flying Aer Lingus, bag drop queue. She said, the wife, Aoife, that she was nervous about travelling through the airport because, you know, how busy it's been and all the stories. They were there for 3. It came up saying we were too late for the flight when they got to the bag drop. When we called over one of the people from Aer Lingus, this is a direct quote from Aoife, they said our flight was likely to be on a list of cancelled flights and that if we joined a queue of people waiting to hear if their flights have been cancelled, they would come and tell us. 1 hour later, the family were informed via text message that their flight was cancelled. Aoife then said there was a mad panic to see if you were going to get your flight sorted. There was such a huge queue for ticket sales, which is the queue you're supposed to join to rebook. She says it was the whole length of Terminal 2. At that stage, she had, you know, very upset children. Obviously, we decided, as she worded it, not to join that. We decided to come home and apply for a refund ourselves for our flight. They paid €6,000 for their 10-day package holiday. And this morning they applied for a refund and began looking for alternative holiday options. And I know my next guest was tweeting about all the cancelled flights from Dublin Airport yesterday. That is, of course, travel and aviation journalist Eoin Corry. How are you doing, Eoin?
I'm all good, Eoin. Happy Monday, Ciara.
I didn't know you were a Gaeilge.
Yes, we do our best. There is a girl, there is a few of us in County Kildare, yeah.
Yes, unfortunately, I'd love to join that group, but...
You should make an effort, yeah. It's not as difficult as it sounds.
Oh, and I try to make an effort, but I'm very hit and miss, really. Honestly, I have a lot to work on.
It's an interesting one, because I didn't go to Gaelscoil. I went to Sculwer and Clane here with a very good Irish teacher. Some of the listeners will remember Mary Dunhu, marvellous woman. And, we didn't come from that fluent Gaelscoil background, but it still brought me up to broadcast quality that I could do teaching Cahir and writing a Gaelic success. So once you get out of trying to navigate grammar and start speaking the language,
yes,
it's a lot easier than it seems.
You're
at first.
So right. We get bogged down with, you know, the Mokanilok and the grammar and the Urus and everything.
We're putting everyone in bad mood by even mentioning the Tishal Kinderdok. So let's get back to something.
Yeah, let's put that to one side. I was following your tweets yesterday. You noted that today at the time, obviously Sunday, was going to be Dublin Airport's busiest day of 2022. You noted 336 flights departing, minus 7 cancellations. The security queue in Terminal 1 was 1 hour, in Terminal 2, 35 minutes. About 11,000 passengers were due to go through the airport. That compares
111,000, yeah.
Excuse me, 111,000. Thank you. So if we compare it to the other dates, Friday, June 28th, 118,000. That was in 2019. In 2018,
that was the busiest day in airport history.
In 2018, it was 115,000. So busy day, but there was 7 cancelled flights. And
more, because the Faro, there were several, there were 3 or 4 more cancellations during the day, and they were the 7 outbound. So we ran into about 14 overall, which out of the 320 odd flights wasn't a huge proportion. But with added to the rail, to the fact that the airport is bursting at the seams, everyone is queuing for a long, long time because of the security, well publicised security queue shortfalls. Airline staff under pressure with COVID, the service areas all under pressure, baggage handling under pressure. It just added to enormous stress. And then we had that, the unexpected cancellations, which really put the tin hat on everything.
I mean, these people, families, not just having to get on another flight, completely missing their flights to their destination because of, you know, a lack of staff at the airport. I know some people weren't able to get on flights to Croatia. That seems to be very popular this summer season. And they tried to get on the next few flights, but they were fully booked, meaning, you know, their holiday was cancelled. €6,000 we're talking about here. In the case of the Comerford family, how likely is it they'll see that €6,000? And how soon, if it is likely they'll see it, will they actually get it back?
You're entitled to compensation if the flight is cancelled. The airline has a lot of obligations to you. They have an obligation to get you to where you're booked as quickly as possible using an alternative airline if they need to. They're, in that case, in the case of the holiday that you've booked, that's normally what the obligation on the airline is. But we're well versed, as opposed to the airport. When Dublin Airport caused people to miss their flights, there isn't a great raft of consumer law in place showing the obligation of an airport. There is lots to do with airlines. And the famous EU 261 2004, it's been well tried all through courts all through Europe and in the European Court. So the rights are pretty well set out. You go back to the airline looking for your compensation. If there's any dispute about it, you have an arbitration process in Ireland that's run by the website flightrights.ie. It's an official government-appointed Commissioner of Aviation Regulation. So everything that, the horror, we're not understating the horror as a family. You know, you're cooped up for 3 years, you're waiting for this great holiday, and then you face the horror of the airport plus the cancelled flights. We're not understating any of that, but there is recourse to compensation. Where does it get complicated, Ciara? It gets complicated when there's an intermediary involved. If you book through a third party, if there's some issue about the accommodation, what did, you know, who was paid for the accommodation? There, again, your recourse is much simpler if you've booked through a travel agent, like Newbridge Travel, one of the established travel agents in the county, and they're subject to their license, they're bonded, they're overseen. But if you've gone through one of the third-party websites, it's less clear-cut. I'm not saying you don't get the compensation, but during COVID, a lot of that unraveled. So good raft of consumer legislation in place, and the case law and the precedents are all in place. It's very hard to make a statement in general about people who have had flights cancelled over the weekend and what they're entitled to, you know, to make a blanket statement. I just say that okay. The law is well tried and trusted on this.
Okay, right. This time of year, always going to be the busiest time of year for Irish holiday makers. What is it looking like up until the end of August, beginning of September, in terms of the airport? I've heard just stories from people saying that their airline had cancelled their flight, some people being told it was due to illness, COVID-19 in particular. It's impacting, obviously, everybody still, meaning airport workers, security queues, you know, airline staff, etc., etc. The rest of the summer, will this continue the way it seems to be? I've also heard people are not happy with the actual physical state of the airport.
Oh, yeah. The airport, it's dirty. You know, the service areas, getting a cup of coffee has become a drama. Doing anything in the airport has become a drama. And the number of lost bags is off the scale. Inbound when you're coming back, the number of people, particularly if you've transferred through Heathrow, which has been a sort of a black hole of luggage in the last...
And describe that problem there. Is that due to a lack of staff at Heathrow?
There's a lack of staff everywhere, but a lot of baggage is automated. The barcodes are put on at the check-in desk. Most of what happens with baggage is when that becomes detached or when the incorrect barcode is put on at the check-in desk. What happened in Heathrow, the tech failed. Many years ago, if the tech failed, there'd be a lot of bodies around to sort things out manually. They don't exist anymore. They certainly don't exist since COVID. And that's a little bit of what's been happening in Dublin Airport as well. Even in good time, you know, on an ordinary flying day, you'd have about 50 lost bags in the, due into Dublin Airport, mainly again through Heathrow, as I say. That's gone way over 400 a day. And we have situations where there's bags piled up in Terminal 1 and people arriving and finding their bags because there's nobody actually there to sort through it. If the code doesn't work, obviously it becomes a bigger drama trying to find a bag because you're dealing with photographs of bags.
And the story for the rest of the summer, Owen?
It's going to be pretty close to breaking point. It's going to be, it's the
okay.
Tale of water.
What do you mean by that?
the pail of water is very full, so anything that lands in it is going to make it splash over the side a little bit. We had three cancellations today. Some routes are more vulnerable than others. Some of the airlines, British Airways, removed a lot of their schedule, including a lot of their Dublin schedule, because they know they don't have the staff to meet it. Aer Lingus didn't do that, and Ryanair didn't do that. But the extra thing, and they've coped really well, while Dublin Airport has had trouble coping, but the extra thing that I'm worried about, and that a lot of people in aviation are worried about, is the air traffic control. Since 2005, we've had nearly 400 air traffic control strikes, mainly in France, mainly in Marseille. That's what caused the cancellations yesterday. And when your French flight is cancelled, it doesn't just affect France. It means that the airport it's going to fly onto after that can also get affected.
And if there's a delay, why is it Marseille in particular that has such an issue with air traffic controller strikes?
It's the structure of the unions. Karlsruhe isn't far, and Germany isn't far behind them. It's the structure of the unions. You've got three competing trade unions in organising the air traffic control, and Marseille seems to be the hub of almost all the problems. I'm not going to play into any stereotypes, but for the southern French airspace as well, that affects Italy, and it affects Barcelona, by the way, because the Marseille airspace goes all the way over to northern Spain. The delays then can put a crew out of hours. It's not like a shop. You can't get someone to work overtime. If a pilot or a cabin crew have reached the limit, you get a new crew in. There's very strict safety limits. That means the likes of the Faro flight from Aer Lingus, I'm not saying this is directly what caused it, but I can speculate with reasonable authority that something like crew being out of hours is what causes flights to be cancelled. So we will see cancellations. Our hope is we will only see 5 or 6 on a busy day. But I'm saying to customers, passengers, when it happens, it's up to the airline to sort it out for you. It's not your stress anymore. They will have to rebook you somewhere. They will have to make sure you get to that accommodation you've paid, not the airport 100 kilometres up the road.
If somebody's listening, or they're not listening to this, they've heard about the airport's issues over the past, and many airports' issues over the past few weeks, few months, and they are trying to back out of their holiday. Does anybody have a leg to stand on there?
It's an interesting one, because there are much more generous cancellation policies in place than there were before COVID. This was caused because of the uncertainty over COVID. But with the big rush back to the skies, I've seen airlines changing the cancellation policies and making them less generous. There's good hotel cancellation policies, and sometimes that they're better than the flight cancellation policies. It's all down to that, the terms and conditions, the print in your contract. My strong feeling is don't pull out of the holiday because you think your flight is going to be cancelled. Remember, we had 10 out of 320 yesterday. That's probably the level of cancellation. It's going to be about 2-3%. If the air traffic control issue runs through the summer, cabin crew, well-publicised, Ryanair strikes had no impact, by the way. All the power is held by air traffic control. If they go on strike, the airlines are told to reduce their number of flights by a certain percentage. That's the power they have.
Okay, Omkari, thank you as always for letting us know. The up-to-date issues with Dublin Airport, looking at Owen's Twitter this afternoon or this morning, he noted that there was cancellations again today, another one of the busiest days of the year at Dublin Airport. Toronto, the 10:35 flight this morning, that is. Amsterdam, the 5:25 flight, and the Aer Lingus flight to Brussels at 6:45. Those three have been cancelled, and obviously we heard about the issue yesterday with cancellations, and again people complaining about the actual state of the physical state of the airport. If you have been to Dublin Airport over the past few weeks, let me know how the experience was for you. The text and WhatsApp line for all the shows here at KFM Radio, 0833 97 97 97. And Catherine has been in touch. Good afternoon to you, Catherine. She says, hi Kira, loving your show as usual. Thank you so much, you're very very kind. Did you know that they have put up the price for Fast Track from 5.99 to $12.99 at the airport. So over 50% increase. I did not get to use it as my flight was at 5:50 a.m. and security advised me that I would be quicker at 3 a.m. to go through normal security than to wait for fast track to open at 4 a.m. I got through in 1 hour and 5 minutes and fast track queues were as big as the normal security. Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for getting in touch, Catherine. I mean, I have to be honest, I really, the thoughts of going through the airport personally just turn me off flying out right now. Really, like, I just, it seems awful. And, you know, the physical state of the airport itself and the prices, like always the prices when you'd go, you know, even get some food or whatever it may be at the airport, they just always seem so expensive. And now even more so, obviously, with our current, you know, cost of living crisis. So, yeah, thanks for getting in touch. Let me know, anybody else, what your experience has been like over the past few weeks. Now, we have been mentioning this on our news throughout the day. I also touched on it this morning during our newspaper review. But in 2021, the Free Legal Advice Centre received over 13,000 calls, 13,147 to be precise. It's to its telephone information and referral line. This was the highest since 2015. I am joined now by the Chief Executive of FLAC. That is Eilish Barry. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, we greatly appreciate you taking the time. The annual report for 2021, as the headline from FLAC's press release, it indicates access to justice crisis. Expand on that for me, please.
Yeah, perhaps if I can just maybe remind your listeners what FLAC is and isn't. We're an independent equality and human rights NGO dedicated to equal access to justice. And we're separate and distinct from, but not, and not to be confused with, the statutory body, the Legal Aid Board, which provides legal aid using means tests, mainly in family law cases where there can be quite significant delays and key areas of law are excluded from its remit. So last year, we carry out a number of activities to try and promote access to justice. And one of the ways we operate is through our telephone information and referral line. And as you said, last year, 13,147 were provided with basic legal information over the telephone. And of those, almost 30% had a family law query and 15% had an employment law query. And so there's a number of aspects about the calls. People tend to be very stressed when they call. The queries tend to be more complex than they used to be and therefore need more time.
Can I just ask you, why are they more complex than they used to be? Explain that a little bit more.
Okay, well, first of all, COVID has thrown up a range of issues that need, that are kind of new and need to be considered. But also, too, before COVID, FLAC used to have a network of legal advice clinics all around the country where you could refer people to for more advice than we could give on the phone line. And we only give legal information over the phone line. But these clinics are based in your local citizens information centres, which were closed due to government restrictions. And it's taken time for them to reopen. So it's put a huge pressure on the telephone information line because there is nowhere to refer people to in an awful lot of situations. So we've tried to resource the phone line to with more staff and with more expertise and with more volunteers, and some law firms are helping us out on that. But I suppose we have two big concerns. First of all, we know that far more people are trying to get through than actually get through to us, and that's something we're very unhappy about. And secondly, when people do manage to get through, we're concerned that we don't necessarily have places where we can refer them to for further legal assistance. And
yeah, almost one third of the queries, as you noted, were related to family law matters. And you said even if the queries weren't related to family law, when somebody is getting in touch with FLAC, it's highly likely that they're in a very stressful state and they're already very stressed by the time they actually get through to speak to somebody. If we look at some of the situations with the legal aid means testing, in one case, one caller was over the threshold by €500 and they were already facing legal costs of over €20,000. That was in a family law matter. In a case like that, Eilish, what happens? Is it just that's it? You miss out by €500. There has to be a line drawn somewhere when it comes to the means testing.
Yeah, no, there's a very strict means test that the Legal Aid Board operate, and their hands are tied on this. But you have to have a disposable income of 18,000 or under. And they, while they give allowances for childcare and for accommodation, they're completely out of touch with what it actually costs people in terms of childcare and accommodation. And the problem is, once you're over the means test by even a euro, that's, you don't qualify. So, and it doesn't matter if your case is complex or really difficult or of huge importance.
And Eilish, I think people can understand that a line has to be drawn somewhere. But, and the argument's always made, you know, oh, but it's just 1 euro or it's just 2 euro.
Yeah.
But that can cause a very stressful situation to become even more stressful.
Exactly. And also too, I mean, the means test hasn't really been, it doesn't keep in line with inflation or wage costs or whatever. So there hasn't been a proper review of it in years. So, I mean, we're actually really pleased. We've campaigned for years for the whole legal aid system to be reviewed. And the Minister for Justice has just recently set up a review group, of which FLAC is a member, who will look at the whole of the system and how it works and try and devise a kind of a fairer, more equitable system than this kind of absolute cut-off if you don't, you know, on what the means test actually should be. So, I mean, that's one of the issues. Another issue that comes up is that people often complain that they've been served with legal proceedings, very often in family law, and they may well be entitled to legal aid. They may actually satisfy the means test, but they're having difficulty actually getting appointments or getting the legal aid cert approved, and we end up having to tell them that they have to go into court and try and delay their court proceedings to allow them get legal aid. And you can imagine that that's very stressful on the caller. It's very stressful on the caller's family and on the other parties to the litigation. And also, it's not a great use of the court's time for cases to be listed, for time to be allocated, and then for it not to go on. So there's all kinds of knock-on effects by people not getting their legal aid in a timely fashion.
I also want to speak about employment law, because there's been a seismic shift over the past 2.5 years when it comes to employees' flexibility within the workplace. Things have really changed, more so than probably any other time in history when it comes to employment. It was the second highest area of queries. And you did note yourselves at FLAC, that is, a steady increase in queries relating to housing matters also. They had increased by 9% compared to 2020. Employment law in particular, Eilish, can you go into some of the details that would have been brought up most?
Okay, well, I suppose what's kind of significant is calls about grievance procedures and redundancies represented 14% of the employment queries, and calls about grievance procedures rose by 47.2%. So I think you're right. I think an awful lot of a huge change within the employment context due to COVID. So a lot of the queries that come into the FLAC telephone information line, they would concern things that have happened because of COVID. So people may have been required in the first instance to work from home, and now have gotten used to it, maybe have all their childcare arrangements predicated on the fact that they are working from home and maybe nearer to their childmind or whatever. And now we're being required, now that all the restrictions have been lifted, to go back into work. And it throws up a whole lot of issues as to how reasonable is it for an employer to now require an employee who's worked satisfactorily at home for a number of years to insist that they're now back at work, and that would go to what's in their original contract of employment. And then how is the employer treating other employees? Because some of the queries we're getting it is that only some employees have been required to go back in and other employees are being allowed to stay at home. So that's one issue. A whole other range of issues that arose during 2021 was people's vaccination status, and was an employer allowed to ask an employee about their vaccination status? And then the other side of that was, could an employee who might be concerned about their own health or the health of family members at home, could they inquire about the vaccination status of other employees? So, but none of those are particularly straightforward. You have to.
I was just literally, you took the words out of my mouth. I was just going to say how complex the issues were over the past 2.5 years. And those people, in fairness, have every right to question both ways, you know, if they should be asked about their vaccination status, and then if they themselves are worried about the vaccination status. status of people within their workplace or of just their health status, you know, if they may be experiencing, you know, symptoms of COVID-19. Finally, Eilish, I just want to touch on housing matters. As I said, increased by 9%. That was compared to 2020.
Yes, and I suppose housing matters, those figures are still relatively small, but there's a significant increase. But just, I suppose, to tell your listeners, we also run an independent law centre, and where we provide, you know, we can only take on a small number of cases because we only have very limited staff in that area, but they provide representation in cases where people are living in poverty or extreme poverty on occasions, or severe social disadvantage or exclusion. And housing is one of the big areas that comes up, particularly in the law centre. Housing, accommodation and discrimination and social welfare are the big issues that come up in the law centre. And I suppose, in a way, that's been there since before COVID, and for particularly socially excluded groups, that continues on, and probably COVID has made it worse. But for example, we run a traveller legal service, and it would have received 85 new queries, and most of them would have related to housing and accommodation issues. So housing is probably, we would predict, the greatest area of unmet legal need for people living in poverty and disadvantage.
Eilish, before you go, I do want to give out the free telephone information on referral line if people are looking for help. I know you say that you're highly busy at the moment, but of course we still want to get the information out there. Also the legal advice centres, I'll go into a bit of detail there. But that information and referral line is 01906 1010. And if you head over to FLAC's website, flac.ie, the free legal advice centres, the information is available there. So I've just selected Kildare here on my phone, and it notes it's currently offering limited FLAC phone advice clinics in conjunction with the Citizens Information Service, and it gives you the local areas, the addresses of the local areas, Athy, Maynooth, Naas and Newbridge. It also gives you the contact lines there. They will discuss the query with you, it notes here, and if it cannot be answered and an appointment is available for a clinic, they will make it for you. Again, as Eilish Barry, the Chief Executive of FLAC, said, extremely busy over the past 12 months and I'm sure into the future and previously also. And we appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. Thank you, Eilish.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Bye now.
Thank you to Eilish there. And over 13,000 calls to its telephone information or referral line in 2021, the highest since 2015. The number 01906 1010. More information if needed on flac.ie. So research that was carried out by Maynooth University, National College of Ireland and Trinity College Dublin has revealed that 42% of Irish adults have a mental health disorder and more than 1 in 10 have attempted suicide. I'm joined now by lead author of this report, that is Dr. Philip Hyland of Maynooth University. Philip, you're very welcome. I know you're an associate professor of psychology at the Department of Psychology in the university. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Kira. Lovely to talk to you.
Out of those 42%, was there mental health disorders that were the most common, Philip?
Yes. So we assessed 12 different mental health disorders that range in severity. So one of the most common disorders, or the most common disorder we saw, was insomnia disorder. So problems and difficulties falling asleep and staying asleep. 15% of the population seemed to be suffering from that condition. At the other end of the spectrum, something like psychosis or psychotic disorder, so, you know, the experiencing hallucinations and delusions that are associated with a great deal of distress, that affected somewhere about 2 to 3% of the population. So there are some disorders that are quite common but are not necessarily, you know, probably hugely debilitating. And then there are other disorders that are associated with a great deal of impairment and distress that are less common. But something like major depressive disorder, which is an incredibly debilitating disorder, affected 12% of the population, and alcohol use disorder was affecting 9% of the population. So some of these disorders are also very common and very impairing.
If we begin with when the survey or the research was conducted, when was it actually conducted?
We carried out this work in between March and April of 2021. So this was carried out about a year ago, and it was part of actually of an ongoing study where we were tracking the Irish population from the start of the COVID-19 pandemic to see how people's mental health had been changing or being affected by the pandemic. So this study, where we assessed a whole range of mental health disorders, was about this time last year.
So people, these 42% of adults, met diagnostic requirements. It didn't mean, though, necessarily, Philip, that they had been professionally diagnosed by a clinician themselves privately. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay.
And we actually do know from other research that quite a high proportion of people who suffer from mental health disorders do not get a professional diagnosis, that they don't approach their GP or they don't approach a mental health professional for a diagnosis. So a great many people go through their life with an undiagnosed mental health condition.
Did you ask people about that?
We did. We asked people if they had ever received a diagnosis, if they were undergoing any treatments for a mental health condition. So people would reveal, people do reveal that they have in the past received a diagnosis, but we didn't actually ask them if they had, you know, received a diagnosis for a particular condition that we were screening them for.
And did you ask them why it may be that they wouldn't approach a mental health professional or a GP about mental health issues they may be experiencing?
No, that's a great question. I'm sort of kicking myself now that we didn't do that. But we actually do know quite a bit about that from other research again, that, you know, a lot of people who have mental health conditions, I mean, while it can impact their lives, I mean, as we know, with that many people suffering from a mental health condition, people get on with their lives. People find a way to function. They can go about their lives. They can develop relationships. They can go to work. They just suffer. It's there in the background. I mean, it's just making things a little bit harder. So unfortunately, a lot of people wait until their life is really greatly affected before they seek treatment and they seek help.
Yeah, and it's quite emotional to think about that, to know there's so many people out there, you know, having these horrible feelings, and they feel like, you know, they have to wait until they get to, I guess, a breaking point in many cases.
I think so. And I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to do this research and to publicize this research, which is to, I think, hopefully change people's minds that mental health problems are not abnormal and they're not uncommon. You know, I think that was something maybe our field of psychology is quite guilty of, is maybe perpetuating an idea for quite a while that mental health disorders are abnormal or uncommon, that they only affect a small proportion of people. And we know now, over the last decade or so, from really fabulous research in many parts of the world, that, you know, what we found in our study mirrors what's been found in other countries, that about half the population at any point in time will have a mental health disorder. We know that by the time people reach their 50s, right, so once you get into middle age, upwards of 85% of people have had a mental health disorder at some point in their life. So it's actually the abnormality is for somebody to get through life without having a mental health condition. So hopefully, while it can be quite hard to hear maybe that there are so many people out there suffering the effects of mental ill health, if anybody is suffering from those effects, they should really know that they're not alone, that there are many, many people in the world who are also suffering.
And Philip, going back to when it was carried out, between March and April of 2021, so we'd been going in and out of rolling lockdowns. I can't fully remember, even though it's not that long ago, but I believe we were in a lockdown at the time. If you were to have carried out that research with, say, March, April 2019, do you think the percentages would have changed majorly? Or would they have been quite similar?
No, I don't think they would have changed. So we've tracked population, as I said, from the start of the pandemic, and what we noted is that there's very little overall change in rates of mental health problems. We were able to compare the number of people who were suffering from mental health problems like depression and anxiety during the pandemic to the number of people who were suffering from these conditions before, in February 2019 actually. And again, what we found was that the pandemic had very little effect on people's mental health. And that mirrors, again, a lot of findings that we're seeing internationally as well. So I actually don't think the timing of the study has a major bearing on the number of people that we detected. And actually, the reason I think that as well is, as I said, when we go to data that the World Health Organization has obtained from many countries in the world, we see the same thing. We see about 40% of people 40% of adults in the population will be suffering from a mental health disorder at any point in time.
The only reason I'd follow up this question is because so many people had such a difficult time with the lockdowns. And we spoke a lot on the station now, and I know this goes into a different area in many ways, but, you know, about, would say, domestic abuse, emotional abuse, you know, having to experience these things at a heightened level, not being as easy to escape. And I don't even mean just domestic abuse, but maybe tense situations. People didn't have the same ability as they did when the lockdowns weren't in place and there was, you know, a pandemic declared. Can that, or do people like yourself in the field not see that as a potential problem down the road? Because it does seem, and this is from conversations with mental health professionals, that their waiting lists are increasing. I know waiting lists overall in the public health service and private health service probably also are, but they're increasing because more and more people are reaching out for help. Do you think the pandemic gave them a moment to think, okay, maybe everything's not okay with me, and maybe sitting with myself for such prolonged amount of time than I ever would previously in my life has shown me that you can reach out for help, as you say. There's always help there.
I think so. I think the first thing to acknowledge is part of what you said there is absolutely right, that there are people who've been greatly negatively affected by the pandemic. So when I said we haven't seen a change in the overall mental health of the population, that's looking at, you know, like a 30,000 foot perspective. When we dug into the data, you can see that there are some people whose mental health has greatly improved over the course of the pandemic. You know, so their work-life balance has improved, their connection to family and friends improved. But unfortunately, there is another group of people who really suffered during it. So we found about 10% of the population, their mental health severely declined as a result of the pandemic. And I think something like domestic abuse is something really important to highlight, because people who found themselves in those situations, I mean, it's impossible to imagine that they weren't, that their mental health wasn't greatly affected by the circumstances that they found themselves within. I think the increasing access, or, you know, seeking out access to mental health care, of course, the HSE and the mental health services in Ireland did an incredible job during the pandemic. You know, people's access to care was affected. Their access to the GP was affected. Access to mental health professionals, counsellors, psychotherapists was affected. So I think what you're seeing there in the increased numbers of people looking for treatment is just the disruption to the normal services.
Philip, did you look into it at all, the difference between introverts and extroverts? Because I personally think that would be so interesting to study. People I know who are more on the introverted side probably weren't as affected by the lockdowns, for obvious reasons, as those who are more, you know, I guess, extrovert.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. We did look, we measured people's personality to see if, you know, personality, you know, traits did influence how mental health changed over time. We didn't see, you know, a tremendous effect for that. But I think you're right. I would suspect that if you really focused in on that, right, there's somebody who's highly introverted, there's a sort of match between the external environment and their internal state. That's, you know, probably quite nice and quite conducive to good mental health. Where somebody who's very extroverted, who likes to be around people, who gets enjoyment out of that, if the circumstances change such that they're not able to live their life in the way that they wish to, you know, you would expect to see some distress there. But I think this is an important point as well, just to stress that, you know, suffering stress or distress, it's not the same thing as developing a mental health condition. You know, so some people, we can find ourselves in circumstances that are very difficult, that are very stressful, that are hard, we're not particularly happy. But that's not, you know, the same thing, or it's not equivalent to the development of a mental health problem like depression or generalized anxiety disorder.
And just, you know, mentioning generalized anxiety disorder, that's one of the most common disorders at 7% out of the 42% of adults in this country that were diagnosed with a mental health disorder. Really, important to highlight this part, Philip. 11% of the respondents reported having attempted suicide at some point in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And people with a mental health disorder were 5 times more likely than those without to have attempted suicide. Now, the disorders most strongly associated with attempting suicide did include psychosis, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, borderline personality disorder, and also insomnia disorder. And again, insomnia disorder was the most common disorder at 15%.
Yeah, very interesting. So generally speaking, I mean, the disorders that were most strongly associated with a history of attempted suicide were those ones that, you know, the psychiatric and psychological community would consider to be the most severe and the most impairing. So things like psychosis and complex post-traumatic stress disorder. But yes, the insomnia disorder was there as well. The insomnia disorder in and of itself was associated with an increased risk of suicide. And it's interesting because insomnia disorder tends to go alongside other mental health disorders. So people who suffer from anxiety, suffer from depression, they'll also tend to have insomnia disorder. So you can imagine it, right? If you're very, very anxious, it's hard to fall asleep. It's hard to stay asleep. Your mind is constantly constantly working and worrying about things in your life. So it is very interesting. I was somewhat surprised by that finding, that insomnia disorder was so important in understanding people's risk of suicide. So it tells us, given how common it is in the population, you know, if we could intervene at a general level and try and improve the mental health of the population, insomnia disorder would be a very good target. You know, doing things to help people sleep, to improve their sleep patterns, you know, we would see quite a good impact at the population level.
The research is incredibly interesting, Philip. If people want to get more information, they can go on to the universities, as I noted, that did partake, including your own, which was Maynooth University, the National College of Ireland and Trinity College. 42% of Irish adults have a mental health disorder, and more than 1 in 10 have attempted suicide. They were some of the key findings of the study. And of course, we appreciate your time this afternoon. That is Dr. Philip Hyland, Associate Professor of Psychology at the Department of Psychology in Maynooth University. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Kira.